Welcome to the reading of the Des Moines Register for Monday, June 28th, 2021. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan. Things are changing quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide our listeners with as much information as we can. In order to do that, we've changed our programming schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also introduce information about resources in your community during each paper. You will still hear your Des Moines Register each day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. This hour includes from the Storm Lake Times and Webster City Freeman Journal. Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Tuesday through Sunday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette is now read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., Sunday through Friday. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m. 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 a.m. Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Go to iowaradioreading.org. Click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcast. The papers will be organized by region. Keep yourself safe and thank you for listening. Here's the first story from the front page of today's Des Moines Register. We are causing them to go extinct. Humans are a major threat to species. This University of Northern Iowa professor is working to save rare Iowa turtles. This was filed by Cleo Correggi, Iowa City Press citizen. Dateline, Cedar Falls, Iowa. At about 30 years old, She-Hulk is known for her love of poison ivy and for having all her limbs. Early one June morning, she picked up the perfect spot to lay a bundle of eggs on the bank of the Cedar River, one of the few places in Iowa where her kind, the wood turtle, can still make a home. As the custom, she peed in her newly laid egg before meandering back to the forest for a nap. Then a raccoon gobbled them up. Jeffrey Taplin and three students from the University of Iowa waded through fields of poison ivy later that day to find her. Tenderly, they pierced She-Hulk from her hiding spot beneath the leaves. "If this has harmed her in any way, I wouldn't do it," he explained Taplin, a herpetologist taking She-Hulk's temperature. "Usually they just sit there and say, okay, let's get it over with. They've had this happen twice a week for 5 years. They're used to it." Taplin, Iowa's lead researcher on the species and a professor in the Department of Biology, uses data to paint a picture of She-Hulk's ideal world. She prefers to live near a river filled with highly oxygenated water, butted up against sandy beaches in a forest with just the right amount of open space. Hopefully, there's a mulberry tree or two somewhere nearby where she can indulge her appetite. Knowing what makes the turtle tick may help save them from extinction, something that Taplin, now 20 years into his research, has made his life's work. 10.5% of species under threat. Thousands of years ago, wood turtles likely moved south to escape the glaciers that covered the land that is known as Iowa. When the glacial period ended, they came back north. In the process, Iowa's beds of species broke away from the border population and became genetically distinct, or a parable isolate. As far as researchers have deduced, the Iowa wood turtle is found only in the northeastern corner of the state. But She-Hulk and her other wood turtles are also part of more sinister designation. One of the 116 species of woodlife, like mammals, butterflies, and mussels, listed as endangered, threatened, or of special concern by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Altogether, 10.5% of the 1,104 species found in Iowa are under threat. Humans are the leading reason why. As Iowa has lost its prairies, its wetlands, and some of those critters that used to depend on those areas just aren't able to adapt to the changes we have made on the landscape. That's a major reason why they became endangered, the Iowa DNR wildlife biologist Jason Ayol said. Just 5% of Iowa's wetland, or 0.2% of its native prairies, and 35% of its forests remain after being converted to spaces for railroads, housing, industry, agriculture, and other human uses beginning in the 1800s, according to a 2015 DNR report. Tamplin sees the turtles' right to survive like a true herpetologist or a scientist who studies reptiles and amphibians. He understands what it has taken for the wood turtles to have made it this far. Breaking off from a common ancestor some 18 million years ago, wood turtles survived intense period of warming and glaciation. They later persevered despite being hunted for food by Native Americans and European colonizers. They also proved the ability of life coming out of a period of natural global warming during the Mesozoic epoch and evolving so that, unlike most of the world's turtle species, their sex is determined by chromosomes, not temperature. In the last 50, 60, 70 years, 100 certainly, humans are basically causing their extinction, strictly because we don't care. So they survived 18 million years, Tamplin said. And because a combination of our land use changes and a combination of our increased carbonization of the atmosphere, we are causing them to go extinct in 50 years. And so, to me, that's a shame. Finding She-Hulk. For Rachel McDonald, an aspiring conservationist and UNI graduate student, finding the wood turtle is a bit like a treasure hunt. It begins with an instrument that, like a radio, tunes to transmitters that Taplin and his students glued onto the turtle's back. Taplin waves the instrument around, slowly, listening for the beeps that tell him he's getting closer. Students listen for clues, stepping in a wide circle around the professor as gingerly as they can while wearing tall, thick rubber boots. Seeking out the turtle on foot using radio telemetry is Taplin's preferred old-school alternative to sitting at a desk and filtering through data collected by satellites. A teacher since age 23, he's learned it's better for students to experience the same environment as the creatures they study. Whether it's 100 degrees and mosquitoes are incessant, or you know, minus 20 degrees and you're standing on ice when they're hibernating in the rivers, I just feel like it gives you a sense of what the animals are experiencing, Tamplin said. In two decades of field work, Tamplin and his students have found only one baby wood turtle hatched in the wild among roughly 150 total. 47 of those are known to be dead. At least 3 have died this spring. Sometimes I feel like we're documenting their extinction. Here's this one dead. Here's where this one died. There's where this one's eggs got dug up. So that can be psychologically challenging to put all this effort and energy into, and then come out here and say, oh, we're just here 2 days ago, and she's fine, and now she doesn't have a head, Tamplin said. The turtles are part of Iowa's ghost population, or a group of older adults that reproduce regularly, but whose hatchings rarely, if ever, make it to sexual maturity. Tamplin and about 33 students through the years have gathered data about the turtles' lives, like their preferred light intensity, air, soil, and water temperatures, as well as behavioral patterns. At about 905,000 locations across four research sites in Black Hawk and Butler counties. It takes about an hour of searching and data recording per turtle find. Putting in the time to do so, the researchers have identified the main causes behind the wood turtles: dwindling population, habitat loss, climate change, and predation. The turtles' Tamplin studies near Cedar Falls are relatively stationary, never traveling more than 2 miles from where they were born for their many decades of life. Up to a certain point, their age can be measured by the pyramid-shaped, slightly wood-like growth rings on their shells. That familiarity with their surroundings, complemented by a high degree of intelligence, like the ability to solve mazes, and individual personalities explain why She-Hulk might return to the same tree for berries in the spring, able to predict when they will ripen, or why Maggie, her neighbor, spends winters frozen underneath some small ball of roots in the river each year. But their neighborhood has changed in the past 20 years from a rural, lightly populated area to one starting to fill with golf courses and housing developments. The corresponding loss of habitat is disconcerting for turtles so accustomed to their routines. When you study these turtles for long enough, you realize they know exactly what they're doing. They know who lives in their neighborhood. They know exactly how to get to places, Tamplin said. None of this is random. An ideal wood turtle neighborhood includes a river with sandy beaches for egg laying. Nesting season begins like clockwork during the first week of June. But eggs can spend only 24 hours maximum underwater, and rivers in Iowa began flooding in the late 1980s due to changes in land use and climate, Tamplin said. Assuming the turtles can find a place to nest and the eggs are not harmed by floods or drought, there's a third major barrier to hatching: raccoons. They are ultra abundant in part because of encroaching urban spaces providing them with food, and they happen to have an appetite for turtle eggs. About 20% of wood turtles, Tamplin studies, have at least one limb missing from raccoon or other predator. Statistics he can recite at a moment's notice. While She-Hulk is 4 for 4, her closest neighbors aren't as lucky. Thundra, 25, was nicknamed the pristine Miss America wood turtle before her one arm was chewed off. Maggie, 40, is missing her left eye. Gorgon is far unscathed. McDonald, the graduate student, didn't know the wood turtles were endangered before joining Tamplin's research. When people think of endangered species, they think of polar bears and chimpanzees, McDonald said, while traipsing through the woods, searching for her first wood turtle nest, but there's some right in our backyard. Tamplin's research garners $2 million. Inside Tamplin's lab at McCollum Science Hall, a chart hangs on the wall, specifically the healthy balance of phosphorus to calcium for turtle meal times. Shelley, Van Gogh, Hannibal, Coralie, and other permanent turtle residents float in their tanks greeting students. And then there's Stevie, a 4-foot alligator who lives in a contained pond in the corner. New visitors may witness Tamplin scratching the back of Stevie's head, much like helping a dog reach an itch. Tamplin's love for soft prehistoric creatures began long before he became part of a team that discovered the first terrestrial species of dinosaur in Antarctica on a trip there through Augustina College in Illinois, where he grew up. Your usual 8-9-year-old loves dinosaurs and prehistoric creatures. I kind of knew it like this. Most kids are like that, and then many of them grow out of it and become insurance salesmen and businessmen, Tamplin said. So some of us don't grow out of it, And if you're lucky, you can turn that into a career where you're actually fascinated by the work you do. After graduating from Augustina in 1986, Tamplin attended Louisiana State University for his master's and PhD, in part because he wanted to move somewhere with more reptiles than humans. Iowa's relative lack of plant and animal diversity came in handy when Tamplin was looking for places to begin a research enterprise. He wanted to study a species that few knew of, but could be of interest to residents and taxpayers, so he chose the wood turtle. He almost gave up the idea after a year and a half of unsuccessful searching in Iowa's woods and riverbeds, until the fateful day when a student dog uncovered one. Tamplin hit a personal record for finding them in the wild that same day, 5. Tamplin's work has garnered almost $2 million in funding since he came to Iowa in 2001. That includes a $221,000 grant from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, made official in January, that will allow him to extend the research up to Minnesota. The contract will begin July 1st. Federal dollars through the years have allowed him to ask what it feels like every question imaginable about the wood turtle, which at this point he can recall at a moment's notice. Data provided by researchers like Tamplin and his students allow state wildlife agencies to better manage the species' habitat. Without researchers hundreds of hours out in the field, for example, it would likely be unknown that wood turtles prefer to spend time in open, semi-sunny spots of the forest. When the DNR created some of those spaces for a particular population of wood turtles, they hung out there most of the year, Arl said. Every time I'm with that guy and we are talking about wood turtles, I'm learning something new, he added. Next, we have Iowa Poll, a Register exclusive since 1943. The question is, what do Iowans think of charter school law? Majority against formation of schools without local board okay. This was filed by Samantha Hernandez of the Des Moines Register. A majority of Iowans oppose a new law allowing groups to form charter schools without approval from the local school board, a new Des Moines Register/Mediacom Iowa poll finds. In her condition of the state address in January, Governor Kim Reynolds called for the legislature to expand options for parents by making open enrollment available for every district and by giving communities more flexibility to create public charter schools. Charter schools are publicly funded institutions that can follow separate curriculum or structure from traditional schools. Reynolds signed the bill into law in May. It allows groups to apply directly to the Iowa Department of Education or permission to form a charter school. Previously, charter schools could form only with the approval of the local school board. The poll shows 55% of Iowans oppose the law change, 33% favor it, and 12% aren't sure. The results are largely some regardless of respondents' age or whether or not they have children under the age 18 at home. Men are nearly twice as likely to approve the change as women, although a slim polarity of men oppose the new law. 44% of men favor the change, while 45% are opposed. Nearly two-thirds of women, or 65%, oppose the new law, while less than a quarter, 23%, favor it. The poll of 877 Iowan adults was conducted June 13th through the 16th by Seltzer & Co. It has a margin error of plus or minus 3.5 percent points. Iowa currently has two authorized charter schools, the Storm Lake, Iowa Central, Buena Vista Early College Charter High School in Storm Lake, and the Northeast Iowa Charter School in Maynard. Both schools are for students in grades 9 through 12. The new law will encourage evidence-based practices and initiative environments, establish models of success for Iowa schools, and create new professional opportunities for teachers and other educators. Creating an environment in Iowa that encourages alternative educational opportunities for those who need them, Reynolds said during the bill signing in May. It doesn't seek to undermine the traditional public school system. The new system will also give parents more choice on where their children attend school, Reynolds said at the time. For poll respondent Bert Juan of Cedar Rapids, that ability to choose is why he favors easing the process for forming charters. The 48-year-old father of four has sent his children to both charter schools and public schools when living in California. California has more than 1,000 charter schools. We, as parents, don't think that public school was benefiting our kids at the time, so we decided to go to a different direction, Juan said. I think we used two different charter schools back then. One was actually through the school district, and it worked great. And we also utilized a different one that was not through the school system. Because of his experience, Juan believes he has a good sense of pros and cons of traditional public schools and charter schools. Juan's 13-year-old son attends public school in Iowa, which Juan thinks is a good fit. It boils down to what a parent thinks is going to work best for their child, Juan says. He also doesn't think school boards should oversee charters. Sometimes the school board would approve a teaching method that a parent disagrees with, he said. I think that it's a parent's decision to decide which way they have their kids educated, good, bad, or indifferent, he says. Poll participant Telemej Kiwan of Altoona, who is black, opposes the charter school changes. He said he believes the new law could allow families to form schools that exclude people of color and those from lower income backgrounds. It's kind of like, I want to be away from them, so I'm going to make a charter school just for my people. And it's like, no, that's not fair. Kiwan, 38, who works as a public school special education associate. Kiwan said he would want his son, who is black and Jewish, to be in a school with kids from a variety of backgrounds. I would be opposed to put him in some place where he would just be ostracized by a group of people. I would rather him be in diverse climates that he can learn to be educated, he said. The law states that charter schools cannot discriminate on the basis of race, creed, color, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, national origin, religion, ancestry, or disability. Kiwan said he feels it is important that charters have school board oversight to make sure students are receiving a quality education. Democrats and public school advocates have criticized the new method for forming charter schools, saying they would not be accountable to local school boards or taxpayers despite using taxpayer money. Republicans say the charter schools will be part of Iowa's public education system, but with more flexibility to offer different types of education. They say the schools must take all students who apply, provide special education services, and follow the same health and safety requirements that traditional schools do. Next, a national news story. The headline reads, Supreme Court may hear more hot-button issues. This was filed by Mark Sherman and Jessica Gresko of the Associated Press. Dateline, Washington. A closely watched voting rights dispute from Arizona is among five cases standing between the Supreme Court and its summer break. But even before the justices wrap up their work, likely this week, they could say whether they'll add more high-profile issues to what promises to be a consequential term beginning in October. This month, the court has already issued big decisions on healthcare and religious freedom, And next term, the High Court has agreed to take on cases about abortion and guns. The court could say Monday what it will do about these issues awaiting action. Transgender rights. A Virginia school board is asking the court to uphold a policy struck down by lower courts that prohibits transgender students from using school bathrooms that correspond with their gender identity. The case has been around for 6 years. Since then, high school student Gavin Grimm filed a federal lawsuit over the Gloucester County Board's refusal to allow him to use the boys' bathroom. Religion. The justices just wrapped up a case involving a church-affiliated foster care agency that declined to work with same-sex couples, ultimately siding with the agency. Now they'll have to decide whether to hear other cases involving religious freedom claims. The pending cases include a dispute out of Washington State involving a florist who refused to provide arrangements for a same-sex wedding. The Supreme Court already sent that case back once to lower courts to be revisited after the court's 2018 ruling on a Colorado baker who declined to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Also awaiting is a case involving a Catholic hospital in Maryland sued by a transgender man who sought to have a hysterectomy. The hospital canceled the procedure, saying it was contrary to its Catholic faith, after learning the reason for it. Abu Ghraib. 17 years after shocking photographs of prisoners being abused at the U.S.-run prison Abu Ghraib were first made public, Iraqis who claim they were victims of torture are still seeking their day in court against U.S. defense contractor that supplied the military with interrogators. The company CACI Premier Technology of Arlington, Virginia, is appealing to the court on a technical legal issue that could delay or even prevent a trial. The inmates say they were beaten and tortured by military police officers before questioning. CACI says none of its interrogators is linked to the abuse suffered by the men. Property rights. The case involves a property the city of Chicago took by eminent domain in order to allow the Blommer Chocolate Company to expand. Agreeing to hear the case would give the court the opportunity to overturn a 2005 case when the court divided 5-4 to say that the city of New London, Connecticut could use eminent domain to make private property and sell it to private developers. The decision was written by Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, who called it the most unpopular opinion he ever wrote. Freedom of speech. A book that became the Hollywood movie War Dogs is at the center of what could become a landmark First Amendment case. Shazikin Bersha, the son of former Prime Minister of Albania, says the book harmed him by falsely linking him to would-be arms dealers from Miami. He sued for defamation and wants the justices to revert the high bar the court has set for public figures to win defamation lawsuits. Next, another national story. The headline reads, death toll increases to 9 in Florida tower collapse. Families' anguish rises with recovery's slow pace. This was filed by Trevor Hughes and Wendy Rhodes of the USA Today. Surfside, Florida. 9 people are confirmed dead and at least 150 remain missing as the painstaking and dangerous search for survivors from a condo building collapse continued Sunday in this seaside town north of Miami Beach. Accompanied by dogs trained to find people and bodies, searchers dug 40 feet deep trenches through the site to assist with efforts, which were temporarily halted early Sunday when the rubble shifted. The trench provided access to new areas, Miami-Dade County authorities said. As a result of that, we were able to recover 4 additional bodies in the rubble, as well as additional human remains. County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava said at a morning news conference. Governor Ron DeSantis said rescue work is proceeding slowly in part because the 136-unit building's rubble itself has forensic value and is being trucked to a warehouse for investigation into the cause of the collapse. They're looking for if there are voids where there could potentially rescue somebody. That's kind of the name of the game, DeSantis said. Obviously, you're going to start to see a lot of major debris that's going to be moved out of there. During the news conference, officials thanked other agencies and the federal government for their offers of assistance. Authorities said they have enough staff to maximize search efforts, taking safety into account. They said sending too many searchers into an area could risk hurting any survivors or other rescue workers by causing correlative lapses. Neighboring Miami Beach declared a state of emergency Sunday, smoothing the way for additional state and federal assistance. President Joe Biden declared the collapse a disaster, a necessary step for helping secure federal assistance, aid, and reimbursements. Anguished family members, many upset at the slow pace of recovery, were given a private tour of the area Sunday afternoon. Journalists were kept away during the visit to the site, where a crane has been lifting away large pieces of debris. A team of Israeli search and rescue specialists joined efforts to find survivors and recover bodies. The members of the team from Israel's Home Front Command are experts in engineering. They marched onto the site Sunday morning to join the search at the 12-story beachfront building, where air conditioners and furniture still occasionally fall. Authorities have been DNA testing to help identify bodies. Many of those who were in the partially collapsed Chaplain Towers South building were Jewish, and as many as 20 of the missing Friday are still of the faith. Mayor Zaba Sardinsky, Israeli Consul General in Miami, told USA Today. The collapse came around 1:30 a.m. Thursday. Video footage captured the rapid disintegration of the building's center and wing in a cloud of dust. Since then, fires and floodings have hampered search and rescue efforts, and authorities have proceeded cautiously, using lasers to measure debris shifts. At the building, the smell of electrical fires wafts through nearby streets, although it's eerily quiet. The public is being kept far away from the site, where dust still fills the air in between rainstorms. Next story headline, Senators Biden scramble to save deal. This was filed by Matthew Brown, USA Today, Dateline, Washington. Only days after President Joe Biden announced a deal with a bipartisan group of senators on infrastructure, lawmakers are racing to save the package from collapse. Senator Joe Manson, Democrat, West Virginia, stressed to ABC News, "This week, there is absolutely still a bipartisan bill brokered in Congress that Biden will sign. This is the largest infrastructure package in the history of the United States of America," Manchin said. "There is no doubt in my mind, never has been a doubt in my mind, that Biden is anxious for this bill to pass and for him to sign it." The infrastructure deal initiated by a bipartisan group of 10 senators that later swelled to a group of 21 was integrated almost immediately after its announcement Thursday evening, after comments Biden made during a news conference on the deal angered Republican senators. "I was very glad to see the president clarify his remarks because it was inconsistent with everything that we had been told along the way. We were all blindsided by the comments the previous day, which were that somehow these two bills were connected," Senator Rob Portman, Republican, Ohio, said on This Week. Portman, one of the leading negotiators on the deal, added Republicans, we're glad to see them disconnected, and now we can move forward. The president's other effort was never linked to the infrastructure effort, Senator Mitt Romney, Republican Utah, told CNN's State of the Union on Sunday. When asked whether he took Biden's backtracking in good faith, Romney was receptive. "I do trust the president," he said. Many congressional Democrats, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, made clear during negotiations that a bipartisan infrastructure deal was only possible if it was coupled with another package that targeted the party's other priorities, like family and labor policy, as well as climate change. In his Thursday remarks, Biden said, "If this bipartisan deal is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it." Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, said he was blindsided by the comments, while Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, South Carolina, called the move extortion. "I'm not doing that. That's extortion. I'm not going to do that. The Dems are being told you can't get your bipartisan work product passed unless you sign onto it what the left wants. I'm not going to play that game," Graham told Politico. In a Saturday statement, Biden walked back his comments, noting they understandably upset some Republicans, and they gave the impression that I was ensuing a veto threat on the very plan I had just agreed to, which was certainly not my intent. Biden welcomed Republican efforts to try to defeat the Democrats' larger package focused on other aspects of the economy, while stressing that the two deals can be brokered in tandem. "I gave my word to support the infrastructure plan, and that's what I intend to do. I intend to pursue the package of that plan, which Democrats and Republicans agreed to on Thursday, with vigor. It would be good for the economy, good for our country, good for our people. I fully stand behind it, without reservation or hesitation," the president said. An international story, headline reads, "Two Saudis women's rights activists released from prison." Aya Barthaway, Associated Press. Dateline, Dubai. Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Two Saudi women's rights campaigners have been released from prison, 3 years after a sweeping crackdown by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, targeting female activists who'd peacefully advocated for greater freedoms, rights groups said Sunday. "It now appears that all the women's rights advocates detained in the 2018 sweep have now been released from prison, although the status of one woman remains unclear. The London-based ALQST rights group, which primarily focuses on Saudi Arabia, said the two women, Samar Bawaldi and Nisima Al-Salda, were released sometime late Saturday or early Sunday. Human Rights Watch also confirmed their release. The women had been sentenced to 5 years imprisonment, two of which were suspended. They had been vocal critics of Saudi Arabia's male guardianship laws, which give husbands, fathers, and in some cases a woman's own son, control over her ability to obtain a passport and travel. They had also advocated for the right of women to drive. Both restrictions have since been lifted. The two women remain barred from travel abroad for 5 years as part of their conditional release," rights groups contacted by Associated Press said. Like other Saudi women's rights activists released from prison, rights groups said the two were likely face bans on speaking to the media and posting online about their case. Most of the women detained in the Crown Prince's campaign were arrested in May 2018, but Bawadi and Al-Salda were detained several weeks later in July of that year. Nearly a dozen of the women previously told Saudi judges they were caned on their backs and thighs, given electric shock, and waterboarded by masked men during interrogations. Some women say they were forcibly touched and groped and threatened with rape and death. One of the women attempted suicide in prison. The Saudi government has not commented on the individual cases of most of the women, nor publicized their charges. It is unclear what Bawadi and Alsada were found guilty of. Several people with knowledge of Alsada's case said she's been charged under a cybercrime law and was found guilty of undermining public order by communicating with foreign journalists and organizations. Next, reset begins for U.S.-Israeli relations. Nations governments looking to turn the page. Filed by Lori Kelman, Matthew Lee, and Ellen Kinkmeyer of the Associated Press. Dateline, Rome. Hush-hush diplomacy. In-person visits. Hush-hush diplomacy. In-person visits. And a very public, non-Cyprus agreement on Iran. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid met in Rome on Sunday as their new governments took to turn the page on former President Donald Trump and former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, whose close alliance aggravated partisan division within both countries. Now, with Trump sidelined in Florida and Netanyahu leading the opposition, President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Naftali Bennett are focused on pragmatic diplomacy rather than dramatic initiatives that risk forming opposition at home or distracting from other priorities. In the past few years, mistakes were made, Lapid told Blinken as they sat down for talks in a Rome hotel. Israeli bipartisan standing was hurt. While we will fix those mistakes together. Lapid said he had spoken with Democrats and Republicans since taking office and had reminded them all that we share America's most basic values, freedom, democracy, free markets, and constant search for peace. Blinken noted that given though the two governments are new, the foundation that we're working on is one of the enduring partnership, a relationship friendship between the United States and Israel. The push means aiming for similar achievements, such as shoring up informal ceasefires that ended last month's war with Gaza's militant Hamas rulers, and replenishing Israel's Iron Dome defense system. A major push to revive the long dormant peace process between Israel and Palestinians could unsettle the delicate balance. Nobody thinks it's a good idea to start charging through on a major new peace initiative, said Ian Goldenberg, a Mideast Secretary expert at the nonprofit Center for a New America Security. But there are things we can do quietly under the radar on the ground to improve the situation. That approach of managing the conflict rather than trying to solve it may succeed in papering over domestic divisions, but it also maintains a status quo that the Palestinians find increasingly oppressive and hopeless, and which has fueled unrest. The Americans and Israelis will try to work out differences away from the public, as in Biden's quiet diplomacy, when he privately urged Netanyahu to wind down the Israeli-Hamas war ahead of a truce that took effect May 21st. We believe the way to discuss those disagreements is through direct and professional conversation, not a press conference, Lapid said. Both governments will try to preserve Israel's fragile governing coalition, in part by reducing provocations that played a part in sparking the 11-day war that claimed at least 254 Palestinian lives and killed 13 people in Israel. The new coalition in Israel shares little beyond the conviction that Netanyahu had to go. It's comprised of 8 parties, each effectively with veto power on decisions. So if one party bolts, Israel's government could be at risk of collapse with Netanyahu waiting. In the short term, Lapid, a centrist, will be Israel's point man on repairs to the tattered relationship with Biden and the Democrats. The party controls both houses of Congress, but is increasingly divided on the Midwest conflict, with progressive members calling for the U.S. to exert more pressure on Israel. What they're building now is mutual trust, said Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States under Netanyahu. I expect a change of tone rather than of substance, but there's a possibility that it could produce something better for Israel. Topping the agenda in both countries are talks in Vienna over reviving Iran's 2015 accord with world powers to limit Tehran's ability to develop nuclear weapons. Trump, with Netanyahu's backing, pulled the U.S. out of the deal in 2018 and imposed sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Biden promised to restore and expand the agreement. Now, Israel's new government seems intent on engaging and influencing the talks rather than shuttling them. Israel has some serious reservations about the Iran nuclear deal that is being put together in Vienna, Lapid said. Before pledging that Israel would voice its objections privately, Netanyahu had loudly and publicly opposed the deal when the Obama administration was negotiating it. We have had the same objective, Blinken said. Sometimes we differ on the tactics, and I think are very clear and direct to each other when that's the case, and that's exactly how it's supposed to be. Even the right-leaning Bennett, who is ideologically aligned with the hawkish Netanyahu, has toned down the rhetoric on Iran. We will continue to consult with our friends, persuade, discuss, and share information and insights out of mutual respect, Bennett said Thursday. But at the end of the day, we will be responsible for our own fate, nobody else. Tamping down tensions, or at least not inflaming them, is a key strategy, the officials said. Blinken spoke of the need to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but did not offer any kind of timetable or any strategy to offer a more helpful future for everyone. Palestinians and Israelis are alike with equal measures of opportunity and dignity. And while Biden administration supports and hopes to extend on the Trump-era Abraham Accords that normalized relationships between Israel and several Arab countries, Blinken said they are not a substitute for engaging on the issue between Israelis and Palestinians that need to be resolved. On the U.S. side, the Biden administration has made clear it wants to extricate the country from intractable conflicts in the Middle East and focus on other challenges, such as climate change and competition with China. On Monday, outgoing Israeli President Reuven Rivlin was to visit Washington at Biden's invitation. A group of House Democrats were planning an official trip to Israel as soon as Congress begins its July 4th recess. Next, Thailand acts to curb spike in virus cases. Associated Press, Dateline Bangkok. Faced with a sharp rise in coronavirus cases, the Thai capital on Sunday announced a ban on indoor dining and gatherings of more than 20 people, in addition to the closure of construction sites and the sealing off of work quarters in Bangkok and 9 other provinces. The measures will remain for 30 days. Thailand reported 3,995 confirmed cases, and 42 dead in the last 24 hours. The numbers have doubled recently, and health officials blame a lack of cooperation from migrant workers employed in construction and in factories. Camps were closed, but workers sneaked out to markets and communities and spread the disease. Asprami Surigasan, spokesperson for the Center for COVID-19 Situation Administration said Friday. She said that bubble and seal disease control measures had proved successful within 28 days in handling clusters in Samut Sokhon province, south of Bangkok, but not the capital. The situation has become critical as the number of hospital beds in Bangkok for seriously ill COVID-19 patients is running short despite the creation of several field hospitals. Next, classified UK papers found at bus stop. Sylvia Hoy, Associated Press, Dateline London. Sensitive documents containing details about the British military have been found at a bus stop in England, the BBC reported Sunday. The papers included plans for a possible UK military presence in Afghanistan, as well as discussion about the potential Russian reactions to the British warship HMS Defender's travel through waters off the Crimean coast last week, the BBC said. The broadcaster said a member of the public, who wanted to remain unnamed, called when they found the pile of documents, about 50 pages in all, in a soggy heap Tuesday behind a bus stop in Kent, southeast of London. The Ministry of Defense and an employee had reported the loss of the documents last week. It did not provide details about the incident or confirm the documents were found at a bus stop. The Ministry of Defense was informed last week of an incident in which sensitive defense papers were recovered by a member of the public. It said in a statement, "The department takes the security of information extremely seriously, and an investigation has been launched. It would be inappropriate to comment further." John Healy, the defense spokesperson for the opposition Labour Party, said the incident was both embarrassing and worrying. Ministers must be able to confirm to the public that national security has not been undermined, he said. Some national news in brief. Five who died in New Mexico hot air balloon crash identified. Dateline Albuquerque, New Mexico. Authorities on Sunday released the names of the pilot and two couples who had died after a hot air balloon they were riding in struck a power line and crashed onto a busy street in Albuquerque. The pilot was identified as 62-year-old Nicholas Melski and the four passengers as Susan Montoya, 65, John Montoya, 61, Mary Martinez, 59, and Martin Martinez, 62. All were Albuquerque residents. The gondola detached from the envelope and crashed in the median of a street before catching on fire, authorities said. Next, fire sets at least 16 boats ablaze in Hong Kong. Dateline, Hong Kong. A fire engulfed 16 vessels in a Hong Kong typhoon shelter earlier Sunday, resulting in at least 10 boats sinking and one person sent to a hospital. The fire broke out about 2:30 a.m. at the Aberdeen South Typhoon Shelter in Hong Kong and was extinguished more than 6 hours later. Firefighters rescued 35 people from vessels during the fire, according to public broadcaster RTHK. There were no reports of any injuries, although one person was sent to the hospital. It wasn't immediately clear what caused the fire. Next, immigrant death in Italy spurs farm work ban in hottest hours. Dateline, Rome. Outdoor farm work under the afternoon sun on particularly hot days has been banned in the southern Italian region following the death of an immigrant who fell ill while tolling in a field and collapsed. Governor Michele Emiliano, who leads the Pergola region in the heel of the Italian peninsula, signed an ordinance on Sunday that forbids farm work from 12:30 to 4 p.m. through August on days that are particularly torrid. The cause of the 27-year-old migrant's death on Thursday is under investigation. Next, Hong Kong, Apple Daily editor-writer arrested at airport. Dateline Hong Kong. An editorial writer of the defunct Hong Kong pro-democracy newsletter, Apple Daily, was arrested at the airport on Sunday night while attempting to leave the city, local media reported. South China Morning Post and the Citizen News cited unidentified sources saying that Feng Weiskong was arrested on suspicion of foreign collusion to endanger national security. He is the seventh Apple Daily executive to be arrested in 2 weeks as Hong Kong authorities crack down on dissent in the semi-autonomous city. And that does it for the first hour of the Des Moines Register on IRIS, the IO Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Up next, we'll give a shout out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan. Thanks for listening.